Welcome to the Physics Teaching Podcast, the podcast made by physics teachers for teachers of physics, or something along those lines.
Physics teachers like me, Thomas WP, a part-time, A-level mostly, teacher of physics, and year seven, and I'm still teaching space. It's great. It's really fun. They just had the best questions.
And physics teachers like me, Robin Griffiths, full-time, year 8 up to year 13, and you're teaching space to year 7, that's fantastic. That's probably the best gig in physics, I think.
Yeah, I think it is. I wish I was in a classroom with them, and I wish it was winter. You know, teaching it in the midsummer is not great. And now I am also a YouTuber, Robin.
Oh, I did see that, actually. Yes, it's sort of, if you can imagine physics in the lab done by a member of STEPS, that's the only way I can describe it. The shirt is phenomenal, and the fact that you've got it undone pretty much down to your belly button, that's good too. It is like sort of an Open University flashback. It's rather lovely.
It should be black and white. And we are joined today by special guest Jo Moore. Should I call you Dr. Joan Moore? You're an ex-medical doctor, aren't you?
Yeah, the students call me Dr. Moore, but I know there's a bit of an argument about whether a PhD or a medical degree is more of a doctor. A PhD is more of a doctor than a medical doctorate, I thought, because it's a higher level of qualification. I only have bachelor's in anything, but I am a medical doctor. Yeah, I don't like being Miss or Mrs.
Okay, so we invited Jo on because she is a non-specialist, this wonderful breed of people who take on physics coming from not a physics background. So we invited Jo on to have a chat about that and just to get her view on teaching physics, really. Now, Jo, just tell us a bit about yourself. What sort of school, private, public, that sort of thing?
I'm at a comprehensive in the northwest of England. We've got more boys than on average and slightly more students on free school meals than average.
Okay, and you are in your NQT year. I didn't realise that, but you're in your NQT year.
Yes, I'm in my NQT year, so I'm a 40-year-old NQT.
That's how we could call it, the 40-year-old NQT, because we've had the 50-year-old NQT. And I've checked your Twitter bio. You've had quite a history. You've been a corporate person. You've been an army person. You've been a medical doctor. How did that lead you into teaching?
That's going to be a really long story that would take up the whole of the podcast. So I guess I have to try and do the short version of the story. Probably why I didn't become a teacher in the beginning is because I was told that, you know, if you were bright at school, you did law or medicine. So they were my choices that I was given at high school for careers. It wasn't the best careers advice. And also my older sister was training to be a teacher and there's a little bit of rivalry there. So I sort of dismissed it offhand, I guess, the idea of being a teacher. And then I sort of found myself in all the various different roles that I've done. I've always been involved in teaching in one way or another. So, yeah, it sort of seems like a natural home that I found myself in eventually.
We haven't done a physics in the news for a long time, and I saw something that tickled me this week. I don't know if you saw this. Scientists say most likely number of contactable alien civilizations is 36. Nice. Two significant figures there. Did you see that? What do we think of that?
Well, it's because you can't have a 0.6 of an alien civilization, presumably. discontinuous data, I think. But yeah, yes, I thought it was good. It smacked very much of Douglas Adams. I think wherever he is now in his cosmic plane, I think he'll probably be chuckling over this one, because I do like this. Scientists come up with answer to alien civilizations, and the answer is 36.
So I just love this. The Drake equation, we do narrow it down over and over again. I'm not going to go into the details, but I know one of them is the number of stars with a planet, something like that. And we now know that nearly every star has at least one planet. So we are zooming in on the Drake equation. And I think I'm reading the article here, they worked out that there are 211, exactly, civilizations in the Milky Way capable of communicating with others, but only 36 within range.
Come on, I'm hopeful now. I'm sort of putting up a sign saying, you know, welcome, aliens. Yeah.
They estimate the nearest is 6,000 light years away.
6,000, like, yeah, to be honest. And this is the thing I always love about this. People sit there and say, oh, you know, they found this other planet and it looks like Earth. And you go, yes, but it's 400 light years away. And at current speeds, it would take us about 8,000 years to get there. So it's kind of, yeah, it's great. But it's, you know, I'm afraid we can't do the usual human thing of, oh, we've trashed this planet. Let's go to the next one and start trashing that one instead. That's not an option. No matter how much we'd like it to be.
No, it's really not. So here are we chatting about physics. And Joe, I mean, I just need to understand a bit better. I mean, you did a medical degree, so you're sort of a biochemistry bit of physics. And when you, what did you choose when you did your PGCE?
Biology, I thought, was probably the easiest one to prove, rather than chemistry or physics. So I just thought it'd be easier because I had to send quite a bit of paperwork. So I had to contact Imperial and ask them for like a description of my course, and they kind of laughed a little bit and said, "Oh, you have to prove that you can teach science." And I was like, "Well, yes." So, yeah, I just thought biology was easier. So it doesn't really, I don't really think there's much of a distinction anymore of like pure specialist teachers. And I've always liked the idea of being a bit of a generalist. And I know you're not, it's frowned upon these days to be like a jack of all trades, isn't it? But I prefer the term polymath. That's what I aspire to be.
Yes. Polymath is a good word. I've got to say, I do love only the teaching profession. Only the teaching profession could go to a qualified medical doctor and say, "I'm afraid you have to prove your science credentials." Just classic teaching profession.
I was sitting here, eyes on stalks, that you had to prove it. So a polymath, I like that word too. So how long did it take your teacher training school or your teaching school to work out you were a polymath, therefore by default were a physics teacher?
Well, I'm not teaching in the school that I did my training in. So I did my training in sort of two schools. So as a part of a small skit, we had two science trainees. So we sort of spent the whole year. So right from the very first day. So that was quite nice. It certainly helps at the start of the year with like classroom routines. And they had me teach mostly Key Stage 3 at the beginning. And then the only biology actually GCSE I taught last year is I taught a little bit of the ecology unit, which would be the thing I know the least about in biology.
Because that's far, far from medical medical science, isn't it?
Yeah, which was, you know, and then I taught chemistry and I taught the energy unit of physics. So I taught more chemistry and physics. And when I applied for jobs, they're saying that they needed a physicist. So we don't have a physics specialist at the school that I teach at. It's a fairly small department. We've got 9 teachers. And we've got another valiant person who sort of stepped up and has been teaching physics with a microbiology degree. So they said, "Would you be willing to teach physics?" And I actually have physics AS level, so that makes me the best qualified physicist in our department. But yeah, it's nice to teach something different. I guess the thing is you don't know what you don't know. So, you know, probably here I am thinking I'm doing all right. And if a real physicist came into my classroom, maybe they would be horrified at some of the things that I'm saying.
But I think they'd be horrified if they came into my class too. I mean, I'm always terrified of real physicists. I'm slightly tugging my forelock at Robin all the time.
Rightly so.
So do you teach A-level at your school then?
We don't do A-levels. We offer BTEC, so... nothing sort of really physics-y. We do, we're doing forensics, I think we're offering this year.
Joe, what are the I mean, you've taken on physics like a boss, and you're coming at it from, there must be some physics in, biomechanics in medicine, but what have the challenges been for you? You know, the real things that have stood out, taking on a subject which you're very unfamiliar. Because I'm thinking, my first year of teaching, it was all unfamiliar, the physics, the biology. I mean, stood out?
That's basically what I would say. So because it's all kind of unfamiliar, I would sort of maybe encourage people to sort of step up and maybe do it in their NQT year, because you're not so familiar with any of the specifications. You might know the subject quite well or very well, but you know, you don't necessarily know the ins and outs of teaching it, so it's all going to be new anyway. I mean, I suppose the counter argument to that is that, you know, it's just a little bit of added stress. So, you know, to not have the confidence in what you're saying and also not have the confidence with just being an established classroom teacher. But I don't know. I think it's probably, you know, I like to take on a big challenge all at once. And I found, thankfully, this podcast quite early on in September. So I found just listening to you've done ways to teach certain units, I found that really helped before I was going into the classroom. I felt like maybe I could just take one thing from your podcast and say that in the classroom. And I felt a bit more knowledgeable about what I was teaching. So I have to thank you both very, very much and all the guests that you've had on, because you've probably, you know, saved me this year, really, quite genuinely.
It's an absolute pleasure, Joe. Thank you so much for saying so. To be honest, most of it was me. Thomas just tags along, really.
just edit it.
No, but it's nice to have these conversations because there aren't physics specialists, really. You know, you're in short supply, and to have, you know, to feel like you're getting. So, you know, my mentor has been wonderful this year, but again, he's not, you know, our specialist physics teacher has been teaching it for quite a while, but maybe, you know, doesn't have the knowledge to answer maybe some of the questions that I have of more in-depth sort of physics knowledge. So it's not the physics community or the physics teaching community have been really, really nice. I think people recognize there's a problem with the lack of physics teachers and people are trying really hard to be supportive. So I think maybe I've had more support just in general from the wider physics community than I would have had, for example, if I was teaching biology this year, where people don't see the need. So I think it's been a benefit to me to be teaching physics this year.
Oh, what a wonderful thing to hear. I was going to say, I mean, you're regular. Thank you for listening to the podcast, of course. And we did an episode last week on uncertainties, and I sort of do wonder when we're blathering on about that. I want to follow up on this actually later, but you know, how as a non-specialist, when you hear these geeky physicists talking about stuff that only they can get interested in, you know, what is the value when there's a mark between 3 and 4 on a ruler? How does that bother you, or is that interesting? I'm interested.
I don't know. I think you can sort of watch it from the sidelines and find it sort of interesting. I think I'm surprised at how long you can talk about that for, rather than just a 5 minutes sort of. Okay, I was like half the resolution of the recording instrument. Either side, done. That's sort of my approach. But, you know, you can have quite long, nuanced sort of debates about it. And I guess it's a difference of approach. You know, if I'm coming at medicine, it's like, well, you probably get better by yourself. I can be a little bit more inaccurate. Or if you don't feel better, come back next week and see me again. Whereas if you're trying to send a rocket into space and catch it again on a platform in the sea, you know, those little tiny differences can be the difference between life and death, I guess. So,
well, I think that's true, but I think it's really important. It's a really important point that I think you've kind of hinted at there, which is that we don't, as physics specialists, when we get into these minutiae discussions, which we all love, that we don't end up sort of excluding people or making people feel anxious about talking to us about these things. And that was one of the things that I think both Thomas and I wanted to do with this podcast, to make sure that, yeah, we didn't end up being, and there are some forums where physics specialists like to hold forth and show how smart they are and things like that, and sometimes I, you know, even I as a specialist, it sets my teeth on edge a little bit, just how pernickety and pedantic they are. So, you know, it is a joyous subject and it's a wonderful subject, and the fact that we have so many people teaching our subject for us, if you like, we should celebrate that and make sure we welcome them as best we can.
Yeah, I think everyone has been very welcoming. I love a geeky conversation. Just because it's one that maybe I don't have any input into doesn't mean that I can't sort of enjoy watching it. And it does come from a place of joy. And I don't think you shouldn't indulge yourself those tendencies as real physicists. You know, you're allowed. You know, you've earned that right
yes.
to
Look
discuss
out.
It at
Look
length,
out.
I think.
Well, now you say that. I mean, I did run a survey but after the last podcast. And although two-thirds exactly of people who responded, out of nearly 200, Robin, even I say that's nearly 200, say 3.35 plus or minus 0.05, a solid eighth chose what my initial gut feeling would have been when I started teaching, 3.4 plus or minus 0.1. And then there's sort of outliers, but still 20%, now a fifth of people thought it wasn't one of those two things. And it just shows how broken it is, not broken, how uncertain uncertainties are. And we were talking about energy and trying to consolidate energy and make energy something that's repeatable and predictable. You know, do we need to do the same with uncertainties? And how would we do that? That's a whole other podcast, though.
It's tough, isn't it?
To standardise. I think the difference is, maybe my perspective is that, you know, as humans, we interpret the world in a very human way. But as, you know, proper theoretical physicists, you're trying to think more abstractly and out of the human condition and real proper university physics is well beyond my grasp. It's sort of in, you know, it feels made-up-y to me, some of that stuff. So rather than intuitive, like high school physics, a lot of it can feel quite intuitive and real. Go, I can see that once you get into the, you know, realms of university. Yeah, we're getting into that's made-up-y land in my world.
I stopped well short of made-up-y land, I can tell you.
You've rumbled us there. When I started my third year module in made-up-y physics, they did say this, you swore us to silence and said, yeah, presumably you must have wandered into the wrong lecture theatre at Imperial one day there and sort of found out.
Well, funnily enough, the physicists were some of the more sociable people at Imperial. So, you know, you had the chemical engineers who had lots of free stuff from the breweries and the oil companies. So they had lots of free beer. And then you had physicists that were, you know, pretty social. I probably have been privy to quite a lot of these very physics-y discussions.
Yeah, I think that's definitely a case of in the land of the blind, the one-eyed man is king, isn't it, really? I think this. I do remember it being a little light on this. Anyway, though, that's sort of getting that's a rabbit hole I don't want to go to.
I'm going to drag you back to uncertainties. I'm going to drag you back to uncertainties because I specifically and deliberately said you have a graph with a mark between the 3.4 and the 3.3. because I'd seen it on the exam question. And then that sort of confused people. I think I'm going to ask that again and say, you've got a dot of biro, someone's a fleck of biro, a dot of biro next to a 1 centimetre scale ruler. And by eye, you can't tell whether it's nearer the 3 centimetres or the 4 centimetres. What value do we give and what's the uncertainty?
3.5 plus or minus 0.5, which is somewhere between 3 and 4. I am 95% confident it is somewhere between 3 and 4. But that's not good enough for a physicist, is it?
See, I would agree with you entirely. That's what I would give. I'd be very, 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 very solidly confident that 3.5 plus or minus 0.5 was right. But I don't think that we'd get 100% if we do a poll on Twitter for that. I think Robin would say 3.5 plus or minus 0.25, wouldn't you, Robin?
That's what I ticked in the poll. That is what.
Thank you. There we go, Dr. Joe. See, that's good.
Because you can be confident. Yeah, you can be confident. It's point. I don't know.
Well, you can be confident it's not below 3.3, and you can be confident it's not above 3.4. And the thing is, if you visualise a centimetre in front of you, and you think about a dot that's somewhere roughly halfway by eye between 3.3 and 3.4. I think you would say that you're not saying, oh, that's definitely somewhere between 3.3 and 3.4. You know darn well it's not 3.31 because the dot is nowhere near that. So you're basically saying, OK, I think it's somewhere in the half a centimetre in the middle.
OK, I'm tempted to agree with you here. That is persuasive. What if it was the same biro mark between 3 millimetres and 4 millimetres? Would you say the same, or would you say the width of the biro mark causes uncertainty?
Well, absolutely. Yeah, no, it would do.
Well, in measuring something, you change it. Now, I remember that. I was taught that in my physiological monitoring lessons at university. So, you know, by definition, making that mark has changed the answer.
Yes.
There you go.
Yeah, well, yes, I think the sort of thickness of the mark that you can see, and this is down to it as well, that basically are you talking about resolution uncertainty here? Are you talking about the resolution of the instrument, or are you talking about the actual physical act of measurement? And I think some of the people I noticed objecting to the tweets had kind of conflated the two slightly, in the sense that, you know, we're clearly talking about resolution error here. We're talking about a mark on a scale between two others, and if you can judge, and if it was 1 millimeter, if you look under a microscope to make that a reasonable size, and your biro mark is very small and it sits in between, and you can clearly see that it's exactly halfway between the two, and it's very, very fine biro, yeah, same argument applies. Mm-hmm.
This one's going to run, isn't
it?
It's
not
going to be
write
like
the
whether
book.
Strawberries are alive or dead.
I've given up on the book idea straight away. I tell you, it's just impossible. It's just so uncertain, isn't it? It's so uncertain. What? I mean, all we can do is our best, I guess, and just feel confident. And I always say to the kids, if you can do a practical within 10%, I'm going to be highly sceptical because I just don't think we have the equipment to do it. So if your uncertainties are less than 10%, you've got to be very, very, very solid in your justification.
So that's
Yeah.
Justification is a good word, so I just come in there and say that's exactly where I go with this, because it's, you know, science is about being precise, and this by nature is imprecise because it's an approximation, and it is interpretive and all the rest of it. So I say to the kids that you've got to justify your uncertainties, and by far the easiest way to do that is to do 3 repeats and take an average, because then you've got a range and your uncertainty is actually properly measured. And at that point, you know, you don't have to worry about resolution of meters and all the rest of it. Repeats and averages is the gold standard.
I feel like the physics practicals are kind of almost deliberately bad experiments that put a lot of... put a lot of uncertainty in there. So there's a lot of scope for analysing them. So if you look at the sort of questions that crop up from the physics required practicals, they are a lot about those sorts of things, about numerical things and handling data. So I'm not saying they're terrible experiments and they shouldn't be done. You know, I'm saying that, you know, they prove the fundamental laws, but they're not the most accurate ways of looking at it. So I think it does lend itself quite a lot to that sort of analysis. Whereas if you look at the biology required practicals, it's a lot more linking concepts together, so linking a description with an explanation, and a lot of the more criticize the experiment really comes out in the physics. I think that skill seems to be more developed in the physics GCSE, so I think they're almost deliberately have the uncertainty in the practicals to bring out that skill.
Yes, and sort of easily identifiable controls that maybe they're easy to identify but less easy to control, so that you can get used to that kind of critical view of your data and what's going on, which is such a huge part of science.
Yeah, different methods as well. So there is a lot of different methods for those physics practicals, say, compared to, you know, the biology and the chemistry practicals.
That's true, yes.
I feel humbled here because you're an NQT in physics and you're talking more confidently about some of this than I am.
I've just written knowledge organisers, sorry, for all 3 of the subjects required practicals, and I as part of that I was trying to put the answers in. So I was then thinking, oh, hold on, there's sort of a pattern to these questions that come up in biology. There's a pattern to the questions that come up in chemistry. There's a pattern to the thing in physics. So I think I've just did that like the other week. It's been one of my projects in lockdown, so... That's why I feel there's a difference. It's almost like I don't know if they've planned it that way on purpose, but it looks like, you know, it's a different skill in each subject.
It wouldn't surprise me if they did, and if they'd you know, emphasised the slight differences in character between the different subjects in order to, you know, hit different assessment objectives. It wouldn't surprise me at all.
It's just my impression. It's not based on, you know, any experience. It was, yeah.
Yeah, we need to get somebody on from an exam board. I did know somebody who's retired from an exam board this year, so he might spill the beans, actually.
That's a great idea. If you are working for an exam board and are happy to come on the Physics Teaching Podcast, do contact us. Contact at thephysicsteachingpodcast.com, or you can contact us through Twitter at physicsTP or Instagram, Robin.
Physics_teaching_podcast.
Very good. And there's a contact form on every page of our website, the.physicsteachingpodcast.com, where there's also a shop where you can buy us a lovely coffee or a beautiful sartorially elegant t-shirt.
Yes, a sartorially elegant physics teacher t-shirt, which is, you know, exactly what they'll be wearing at all the heavy metal concerts when lockdown is lifted.
I've got a space t-shirt on right now, especially, just, you know.
Aww.
I'm wearing my CERN t-shirt.
Are you? Well, try and wear that next time you do a practical, because that YouTube shirt is... I'd be waking up at 4 in the morning in a cold sweat thinking that shirt's coming to get me.
When I filmed that, I did not think it was going to be a YouTube video, but when I made the video today, I thought, actually, that's quite useful. If someone else had made that, I'd use it. Anyway, so Joe, you're... Back to Joe. So Joe, you sound like a physics specialist already. You haven't even finished your NQT year. So what... Imagine there's a non-specialist listening who's a bit nervous about physics. What have you really enjoyed about taking on the physics in the last year? Because you sound like you've enjoyed it.
I have really enjoyed it, and I feel, you know, you've got to love it, really. I think the kids deserve that. They think they deserve a good advocate for a subject, and it's not that I, you know, don't see the value in physics, and I really do believe that science in general is something that everyone should be pursuing. And it's not just for like the most, you know, able or the people with the highest prior attainment. It's actually, you know, useful for your own well-being, for your health, for understanding the world around you, for making decisions about, you know, what you spend your money on, what, you know, I was having a, I made my dad buy a new fridge because it would save him money, you know, just but little, you know, things like that. And I think it does, you know, you do need to advocate for, you know, that deserves a good advocate for the subject. And actually a lot of the stuff in GCSE physics is, you know, you can do a lot of the sort of fun demonstrations, you can do a lot of the sort of magic-y things. You know, the chemists get to make pretty colours and flashes and bangs, but I can just sort of delve about in a box and get out a balloon, or I can get out a silly alien jumping toy or a ball, and I can explain sort of a concept for how the world works. You know, I think that's a beautiful thing. So I have really enjoyed it, and there has been a lot of support. It is quite nerve-wracking to sort of, you know, think, oh, then we're going to ask me a question and I won't understand it. But I think, you know, probably the hardest thing for me has been the maths aspect of it, which was my best subject when I was doing A-level. But then I realised I haven't used that maths part of my brain for, oh, you know, nearly 20 years. So and occasionally I've had like nice little moments where I've almost felt the flow come back in the maths, and I've written an answer and then I've been like, oh, hold on, where's that come from? And had to check that it's right. So I think, and I think that's quite nice, because I think that's something that the students worry about as well. They sort of see the maths and go, oh, I don't like it. And I'm sort of almost approaching it from the same way, going, oh, I do know how to do this. And it just means you have to plan it out better. Mm.
Yeah, that's a very good point. I think that there is something about a whiteboard, isn't there, that immediately standing in front of a whiteboard takes your maths IQ down by about 50 points automatically. I remember doing this, that I'd sit there and I'd go through things on paper and it'd be fine. Then I'd stand up in class and think, yeah, I'll go through this. And I'd just make the daftest errors that I possibly could.
Don't know what you're talking about,
deliberate
Robin.
Errors, yeah. Too, that they to can me. Find them, and that makes it build confidence for your students. I heard someone say this and I was just like, that's just genius. Yes, I make one of those mistakes on purpose.
Yes. Yeah, I warn them at the start of the year. I say I make a lot of mistakes, and not one of them will be deliberate. If I make a deliberate error, I'll be so obviously delighted that you'll notice. So I make enough errors as it is without making them deliberately.
I think that's another great education thing, that you can turn anything into an advantage, can't you? You say, yes, I got all the calculations wrong, but that gave the students an opportunity to correct me. Can you imagine using that in your medical trade? Yes, I treated them with all the wrong drugs, but that gave them an opportunity to really learn about the pharmacology involved in their treatment, and so they'll be that much more appreciative of it from now on.
So it was a test of their character. Obviously. Yeah, it was a test of their character.
I was exploring the limits of self-limiting illnesses.
Well, there are quite a lot of papers in medicine that show, you know, actually doing no intervention can be better than treating them. So, you know, they, for a long time in intensive care, you know, they were making people worse with the sort of ventilators and things that they had.
Placebo effect, isn't it? The placebo effect, which is just an extraordinary thing, really, when you look into it deeply.
Yeah, I think that's another area, actually, which, again, there's another whole podcast in, and it's a bit of a rabbit hole to go down. But, of course, one of the reasons they found out that they were doing more harm than good was because of rigorous, repeated data taken over time, and there was a huge amount of research. Ben Goldacre's written his book, obviously, Bad Science, revolves a lot around this, and this idea of using randomised controlled trials in medicine, and how it was resisted initially, and now it's being embraced, and how it's made a huge difference in terms of things like, as you say, overtreatment in intensive care. There's still a huge amount of resistance in education to randomised controlled trials and using them to see if interventions really work. There's still a few sacred cows that could be slain. But like I say, that's another podcast in its own right. And probably
I'd love to get Ben Goldacre on. I've seen him talk. He's brilliant. But how would we squeeze him onto a physics teaching podcast?
Well, yeah, measurement. That's what it's all about.
Measurement, yeah. I think it might be worth a try.
Yeah, or just, you know, talking about sort of bad science, you know, it's definitely.
Well, Ben Goldacre's written articles about how education should make more use of RCT. So I think it's certainly something, obviously, he feels about. So if we could get him on, it would be great.
Well, I think there's a placebo effect sort of to be had in teaching as well, isn't there? Which is, you know, the sort of the ways that you use praise and you know, you tell students, you know, that they're good at something. You know, I like to tell all my students that they're brilliant at science in the hope that they will be better, you know, that they will like it more, because we like things that we're good at, or, you know, that's just human nature. We want to, you know, and we want to be good at things that we like.
You're my favourite ever class.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
My favourite of a class. And walking in like you own the room, it's a priceless aspect. I mean, that's the placebo effect, really, for them. If you walk in as if you know everything you're talking about, then they often they believe you. Like me teaching chemistry.
The head of science at the school I trained at is a bit of an institution. He's been there for a very, very long time. And he tells all the students, even the ones he doesn't teach, that he's their favourite teacher. And he's literally brainwashed every child in that school into saying that, you know, who's your favourite teacher? And they say his name. And I'm like, oh, I need this is mastery at work. I need to try this.
Absolutely. Yes, I always had this thing of saying, you know, whenever I get I was talking to a student one-on-one, I'd say, that's why you're my favourite student, because, you know, you do this thing. Now, I remember doing a revision session with Year 11 once, and one of the students, they'd obviously been talking, and he said, turned around and goes, but you said I was your favourite student. And they'd obviously been talking. I was like, well, yes, obviously, but, you know, in that class, because luckily the person he was talking to had been in another class, I was saying, in that class was what I meant. And the rest of it. So then it became a standing joke.
Joe, I warned you of this as we were preparing. Is there a demo or practical that you have found in physics that you're particularly fond of in your short career?
Yeah, I have to say, and, you know, I was on an Institute of Physics teaching day, and they had these wonderful jumping toys. And I know it's not really a practical or a demo, but I can find a way almost, and I'm hoping this makes me feel like a bit more of a real physics teacher, of getting an alien jumping toy into almost every aspect of physics, really. And yes, and there is no absolutely way that does not make a child smile. You know, if I
is
let
that the
them,
popping toy you push down?
Yeah,
and
the little popping toy, and you weigh, and you know, and you can do all sorts of calculations with it. So trying to get engagement into like the energy calculations, and you bring the toys back out, and you know, forces and predictions. You can use it for everything, really. So
yeah, radioactive decay because it's random.
Yeah, radioactive decay because it's random, and it's just nice to have that little moment because we haven't had they haven't had a physics teacher, I guess, to sort of, you know, my physics teacher when I was at school was really good, and I really enjoyed his lessons. And I just think it's nice to have that joy in the world around them. So yeah, I'm just going to go for a simple alien jumping toy. That's what I'm going to go for.
Yeah, alien jumping toy is a good one. I like that. That and a balloon, I reckon. You're
yeah,
done.
That's it. That's all you need.
Which goes back to our TPTP bits and bobs, which we haven't done, Robin. We'll have to try pick that up next episode. Well, Joe, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. We could go on for hours. Maybe we will another day. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much. I've loved it. So thank you for having me.
Thanks very much, Joe. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. Thanks so much. Do come back and tell us how teaching is going in a year or so.
Yeah, I'd love to. Thank you.
And thank you, Robin.
Thanks, Thomas. See you next week.
Thank you for listening to the Physics Teaching Podcast. And special thanks this week to Dr. Joe Moore. The podcast is presented by Robin Griffiths and me, Thomas W.P., and produced and edited by me, Thomas W.P. If any of you know Ben Goldacre, please ask him to get in touch with the podcast. We'd love to have him on. Thanks for listening, and we'll speak to you next week.